Let's go and greet our host.
Matching their steps, they padded down the remaining stairs and snuck across the room, never taking their eyes off the engrossed magicians.
Are you Lady Lorana?
Asked Arya in a soft voice as they halted before the seated woman. The woman inclined her head.
That I am, fair elf.
She turned her gaze upon Aragorn then and said,
And are you the dragon rider of whom we have heard so much about recently? Are you Aragorn Shadeslayer?
I am, said Aragorn.
A relieved expression appeared upon the woman's distinguished face.
Ah, I had hoped you would come. You must stop them, Shadeslayer.
And she gestured at the magicians.
Why don't you order them to surrender?
Whispered Aragorn.
I cannot, said Lorana. They answer only to the king and his new rider. I have sworn myself to Galbatorix. I had no choice in the matter, so I cannot raise a hand against him or his servants. Otherwise I would have arranged their destruction myself.
Why?
Asked Arya.
What is it you fear so much?
The skin around Lorana's eyes tightened.
They know they cannot hope to drive off the Varden as they are, and Galbatorix has not sent reinforcements to our aid. So they are attempting, I do not know how, to create a shade, in the hope that the monster will turn against the Varden and spread sorrow and confusion throughout your ranks.
Horror enveloped Aragorn.
He could not imagine having to fight another Durza. But a shade might just as easily turn against them and everyone else in Feinster as it would against the Varden.
Lorana nodded.
They do not care. They only wish to cause as much pain and destruction as they can before they die. They are insane, Shadeslayer. Please, you must stop them, for the sake of my people.
As she finished speaking, Saphira landed upon the balcony outside the room, cracking the balustrade with her tail. She knocked aside the shutters with a single blow of her paw, breaking their frames like so much tinder, and then pushed her head and shoulders into the chamber and growled. The magicians continued to chant, seemingly oblivious to her presence.
"Oh my," said Lady Lorana, gripping the arms of her chair.
"Right," said Aragorn. He hefted Brisinger and started toward the magicians, as did Saphira from the opposite direction. The world reeled around Aragorn, and again he found himself peering through Glaider's eyes. Red, black, flashes of throbbing yellow. Pain. Bone-bending pain in his belly and in the shoulder of his left wing. Pain as he had not felt for over 100 years.
Then relief. As partner of his life, Oromis healed his injuries.
Glaider regained his balance and looked for Thorn. The little red trike dragon was stronger and faster than Glaider had anticipated, due to Galbatorix's meddling. Thorn slammed into Glaider's left side, his weak side, where he had lost his foreleg. They spun around each other, plummeting toward the hard, flat, wing-crushing ground. Glaider snapped and tore and raked with his hind feet, trying to batter the smaller dragon into submission.
"You will not best me, youngling,"
he vowed to himself.
"I was old before you were born."
White dagger claws scratched Glaider along his ribs and underside. He flexed his tail and struck snarling Long Fang Thorn across one leg, stabbing him in the thigh with a spike on his tail. The fighting had long since exhausted both of their invisible spell shields, leaving them vulnerable to every sort of wound. When the twirling ground was only a few thousand feet away, Glaider inhaled and drew back his head. He tightened his neck, clenched his belly, and drew forth the dense liquid of fire from deep within his gut. The liquid ignited as it combined with the air in his throat. He opened his jaws to their full extent and sprayed the red dragon with fire, engulfing him in a blistering cocoon. The torrent of hungry, grasping, writhing flames tickled the inside of Glader's cheeks. He closed off his throat, terminating the flow of fire as he and the squirming, squealing slash-claw dragon pulled away from each other. From on his back, Glader heard Oramis say, "Their strength is fading. I can see it in their bearing. Another few minutes and Murtag's concentration shall fail, and I will be able to assume control over his thoughts. That, or we shall slay them with sword and fang." Glader growled in agreement, frustrated that he and Oramis dared not communicate with their minds as they usually did. Rising on warm wind from tilled earth, he turned toward Thorn, whose limbs dripped with crimson blood, and roared, and prepared to grapple with him once more. Aragorn stared at the ceiling, disoriented. He was lying on his back within the keep tower. Kneeling next to him was Arya, concern etched upon her face. She grasped him by an arm and helped him upright, steadying him as he wobbled. Across the room, Aragorn saw Saphira shake her head, and he felt her own confusion. The three magicians still stood with their arms outstretched, swaying and chanting in the ancient language. The words of their spell rang with unusual force and lingered in the air long after they should have faded to silence. The man who sat at their feet gripped his knees, his entire body shuddering as he thrashed his head from side to side.
"What happened?" asked Arya in a strained undertone.
She pulled Aragorn closer and lowered her voice even further.
"How can you know what Glader is thinking from so far away? And when his mind is closed even to Oramis? Forgive me for touching your thoughts without your permission, Aragorn, but I was worried about your welfare. What sort of a bond do you and Saphira share with Glader?"
"Later," he said, and squared his shoulders.
"Did Oramis give you an amulet or some other trinket that allows you to contact Glader? It would take too long to explain. Later, I promise."
Arya hesitated, then nodded and said,
"I shall hold you to that."
Together, Aragorn, Saphira and Arya advanced toward the magicians and struck at a separate one each. A metallic peal filled the room as Brisinger glanced aside before it reached its intended target, wrenching Aragorn's shoulder. Likewise, Arya's sword rebounded off a ward, as did Saphira's right front paw. Her claws screeched against the stone floor.
"Concentrate on this one!"
Aragorn shouted and pointed at the tallest spellcaster, a pale man with a snarled beard.
"Hurry, before they manage to summon any spirits!"
Aragorn or Arya could have attempted to circumvent or deplete the spellcaster's wards with spells of their own, but using magic against another magician was always a perilous proposition, unless the magician's mind was under your control. Neither Aragorn nor Arya wanted to risk being killed by a ward they were as yet ignorant of. Attacking in turns, Aragorn, Saphira and Arya cut, stabbed and battered at the bearded spellcaster for nearly a minute. None of their blows touched the man. Then at last, after only the slightest hint of resistance, Aragorn felt something give way beneath Brisinger, and the sword continued on its way and lopped off the spellcaster's head. The air in front of Aragorn shimmered. At the same instant, he felt a sudden drain on his strength as his wards defended him from an unknown spell. The assault ceased after a few seconds, leaving him dizzy and light-headed. His stomach rumbled. He grimaced and fortified himself with energy from the belt of Belot the Wise. The only response the other two magicians evinced at the death of their companion was to increase the speed of their invocation. Yellow foam encrusted the corners of their mouths, and spittle flew from their lips and the whites of their eyes showed. But still they made no attempt to flee or to attack. Continuing on to the next spellcaster, a corpulent man with rings on his thumbs, Aragorn, Saphira and Arya repeated the process they had used on the first magician, alternating blows until they succeeded in wearing down his wards. It was Saphira who slew the man, knocking him through the air with a swipe of her claws. He hit the side of the staircase and cracked open his skull on the corner of a step. This time, there was no magical retaliation. As Aragorn moved toward the female spellcaster, a cluster of multicolored lights hurtled into the room through the broken shutters and converged upon the man seated on the floor. The glowing spirits flashed with angry virulence as they whirled around the man, forming an impenetrable wall. He threw up his arms as if to shield himself and screamed. The air hummed and crackled with the energy that radiated from the flickering orbs. A sour, iron-like taste coated Aragorn's tongue and his skin prickled. The hair on the female spellcaster's head was standing on end. Across from her, Saphira hissed and arched her back, every muscle in her body rigid. A bolt of fear shot through Aragorn.
No!
He thought, feeling sick.
Not now! Not after all we've gone through!
He was stronger than he had been when he faced Durza in Trondheim, but if anything, he was even more aware of just how dangerous a Shade could be. Only three warriors had ever survived the killing of a Shade. Laitri the Elf, Ernstad the Rider, and himself, and he had no confidence he could duplicate the feat.
Blodgarm, where are you?
Aragorn shouted with his mind.
We need your help!
And then everything around Aragorn winked out of existence, and in its place he beheld
whiteness, blank whiteness. The cold, soft sky water was soothing against Glaeder's limbs after the stifling heat of combat. He lapped at the air, welcoming the thin coat of moisture that accumulated on his dry, sticky tongue. He flapped once more, and the sky water parted before him, revealing the glaring, scorch-back sun and the hazy green-brown earth.
Where is he?
Glaeder wondered. He swung his head, looking for Thorn. The little red shrike dragon had fled high above Gilead, higher than any bird normally flew, where the air was thin and one's breath water-smoked.
Glaeder, behind us!
Oromis shouted. Glaeder twisted, but he was too slow. The red dragon crashed into his right shoulder, knocking him tumbling. Snarling, Glaeder wrapped his single remaining foreleg around the nipping, scratching, ferocious hatchling and strove to crush the life out of Thorn's squirming body. The red dragon bellowed and climbed halfway out of Glaeder's embrace, digging his claws into Glaeder's chest. Glaeder arched his neck and sank his teeth into Thorn's left hind leg, and with it held him in place, although the red dragon writhed and kicked like a pinned wildcat. Hot, salty blood filled Glaeder's mouth. As they plummeted downward, Glaeder heard the sound of swords striking shields as Oromis and Murtagh exchanged a flurry of blows. Thorn convulsed, and Glaeder glimpsed Morzan's son Murtagh. Glaeder thought the human appeared frightened, but he was not entirely sure. Even after so long bonded with Oromis, he still had difficulty deciphering the expressions of two legs, no horns, what with their soft, flat faces and their lack of tails. The clanging of metal ceased, and Murtagh shouted,
"Curse you for not showing yourself sooner! Curse you! You could have helped us! You could have..."
Murtagh seemed to choke on his tongue for a moment. Glaeder grunted as an unseen force brought their fall to an abrupt halt, nearly shaking him loose from Thorn's leg, and then lifted the four of them up through the sky, higher and higher, until the broken Anthill City was only a faint blotch below. And even Glaeder had difficulty breathing in the rarefied air.
"What is the youngling doing?"
Glaeder wondered, concerned.
"Is he trying to kill himself?"
Then Murtagh resumed speaking, and when he did, his voice was richer and deeper than before, and it echoed as if he were standing in an empty hall. Glaeder felt the scales on his shoulders crawl as he recognized the voice of their ancient foe.
"So you survived, Oromis, Glaeder," said Galba Torix.
His words were round and smooth, like those of a practiced orator, and their tone was deceptively friendly.
"Long have I thought that the elves might be hiding a dragon or a rider from my sight. It is gratifying to have my suspicions confirmed."
"Begone, foul oathbreaker!" cried Oromis. "You shall not have any satisfaction from us."
Galvatorix chuckled. "Such a harsh greeting! For shame, Oromis Elder! Have the elves forgotten their fabled courtesy over the past century?"
"You deserve no more courtesy than a rabid wolf!"
"Tut, tut, Oromis. Remember what you said to me when I stood before you and the other elders. Anger is a poison. You must purge it from your mind, or else it will corrupt your better nature. You should heed your own advice."
"You cannot confuse me with your snake's tongue, Galvatorix. You are an abomination, and we shall see to it that you are eliminated, even if it costs us our lives."
"But why should it, Oromis? Why should you pit yourself against me? It saddens me that you have allowed your hate to distort your wisdom. For you were wise once, Oromis, perhaps the wisest member of our entire order. You were the first to recognize the madness eating away at my soul. And it was you who convinced the other elders to deny my request for another dragon egg. That was very wise of you, Oromis. Futile, but wise. And somehow you managed to escape from Kialandi and Fomora, even after they had broken you. And then you hid until all but one of your enemies had died. That, too, was wise of you, elf."
A brief pause marked Galvatorix's speech. "There is no need to continue fighting me. I freely admit that I committed terrible crimes in my youth. But those days are long past, and when I reflect upon the blood I have shed, it torments my conscience. Still, what would you have of me? I cannot undo my deeds. Now my greatest concern is ensuring the peace and prosperity of the empire over which I find myself lord and master. Cannot you see that I have lost my thirst for vengeance? The rage that drove me for so many years has burned itself to ashes. Ask yourself this, Oromis. Who is responsible for the war that has swept across Alagasia? Not I. The Varden were the ones who provoked this conflict. I would have been content to rule my people and leave the elves and the dwarves and the Serdans to their own devices. But the Varden could not leave well enough alone. It was they who chose to steal Sephira's egg, and they who cover the earth with mountains of corpses, not I. You were wise once before, Oromis, and you can become wise once again. Give up your hatred and join me in Illyria. With you by my side, we can bring an end to this conflict and usher in an era of peace that will endure for 1,000 years or more." Glada was not persuaded. He tightened his crushing, piercing jaws, causing Thorn to yowl. The pain noise seemed incredibly loud after Galbatorix's speech. In clear, ringing tones, Oromis said,
"No! You cannot make us forget your atrocities with a balm of honeyed lies. Release us! You have not the means to hold us here much longer, and I refuse to exchange pointless banter with a traitor like yourself."
"Bah! You are a senile old fool," said Galvatorix,
and his voice acquired a harsh, angry cast.
"You should have accepted my offer. You would have been first and foremost among my slaves. I will make you regret your mindless devotion to your so-called justice. And you are wrong. I can keep you thus as long as I want, for I have become as powerful as a god, and there are none who can stop me!"
You shall not prevail, said Aramis. Even gods do not endure forever.
At that, Galbatorix uttered a foul oath.
Your philosophy does not constrain me, elf. I am the greatest of magicians, and soon I will be even greater still. Death will not take me. You, however, shall die. But first,
you will suffer. You will both suffer beyond imagining, and then I will kill you, Aramis, and I shall take your heart of hearts, Gleda, and you will serve me until the end of time.
Never! Exclaimed Aramis.
And Gleda again heard the clash of swords on armor. Gleda had excluded Aramis from his mind for the duration of the fight, but their bond ran deeper than conscious thought, so he felt it when Aramis stiffened, incapacitated by the searing pain of his bone-blight nerve rot. Alarmed, Gleda released Thorn's leg and tried to kick the red dragon away. Thorn howled at the impact, but remained where he was. Galbatorix's spell held the two of them in place, neither able to move more than a few feet in any direction. There was another metallic clang from above, and then Gleda saw Naegling fall past him. The golden sword flashed and gleamed as it tumbled toward the ground. For the first time, the cold claw of fear gripped Gleda. Most of Aramis's word-will energy was stored within the sword, and his wards were bound to the blade. Without it, he would be defenseless. Gleda threw himself against the limits of Galbatorix's spell, struggling with all his might to break free. In spite of his efforts, however, he could not escape. And just as Aramis began to recover, Gleda felt Zarok slash Aramis from shoulder to hip. Gleda howled. He howled as Aramis had howled when Gleda lost his leg. An inexorable force gathered inside of Gleda's belly. Without pausing to consider whether it was possible, he pushed Thorn and Murtagh away with a blast of magic, sending them flying like wind-blown leaves, and then tucked his wings against his sides and dove toward Gilead. If he could get there fast enough, then Islanzadi and her spellcasters would be able to save Aramis. The city was too far away, though. Aramis's consciousness was faltering, fading, slipping away. Gleda poured his own strength into Aramis's ruined frame, trying to sustain him until they reached the ground. But for all the energy he gave to Aramis, he could not stop the bleeding. The terrible bleeding.
Gleda, release me,
Aramis murmured with his mind. A moment later, in an even fainter voice, he whispered,
Do not mourn me.
And then the partner of Gleda's life passed into the void. Gone. Gone.
Gone!
Blackness. Emptiness. He was alone. A crimson haze descended over the world, throbbing in unison with his pulse. He flared his wings and looped back the way he had come, searching for Thorn and his rider. He would not let them escape. He would catch them and tear at them and burn them until he had eradicated them from the world. Gleda saw the red shrike dragon diving toward him, and he roared his grief and redoubled his speed. The red dragon swerved at the last moment in an attempt to flank him, but he was not fast enough to evade Gleda, who lunged and snapped and bit off the last 3 feet of the red dragon's tail. A fountain of blood sprayed from the stump. Yelping in agony, the red dragon wriggled away and darted behind Gleda. Gleda started to twist around to face him, but the smaller dragon was too quick, too nimble. Gleda felt a sharp pain at the base of his skull, and then his vision flickered and failed. Where was he? He was alone. He was alone and in the dark. He was alone and in the dark, and he could not move or see.
He could feel the minds of other creatures close by, but they were not the minds of Thorn and Murtag, but of Arya, Aragorn and Saphira. And then Glaedor realized where he was, and the true horror of the situation broke upon him. And he howled into the darkness. He howled, and he howled, and he abandoned himself to his agony, not caring what the future might bring, for Oromis was dead. And he was alone. Alone. With a start, Aragorn returned to himself. He was curled into a ball. Tears streaked his face. Gasping, he pushed himself up off the floor and looked for Saphira and Arya. It took him a moment to comprehend what he saw. The female spellcaster Aragorn had been about to attack lay before him, slain by a single sword thrust. The spirits she and her companions had summoned were nowhere to be seen. Lady Lyanna was still ensconced in her chair. Saphira was in the process of struggling to her feet on the opposite side of the room, and the man who had been sitting on the floor amid the three other spellcasters was standing next to him, holding Arya in the air by her throat. The colour had vanished from the man's skin, leaving him bone white. His hair, which had been brown, was now bright crimson, and when he looked at Aragorn and smiled, Aragorn saw that his eyes had become maroon. In every aspect of appearance and bearing, the man resembled Durza.
"Our name is Varlog," said the Shade. "Fear us."
Arya kicked at him, but her blows seemed to have no effect. The burning pressure of the Shade's consciousness pressed against Aragorn's mind, trying to break down his defences. The force of the attack immobilized Aragorn. He could barely repel the burrowing tendrils of the Shade's mind, much less walk or swing a sword. For whatever reason, Varag was even stronger than Durza, and Aragorn was not sure how long he could withstand the Shade's might. He saw that Saphira was also under attack. She sat stiff and motionless by the balcony, a snarl carved on her face. The veins in Arya's forehead bulged, and her face turned red and purple. Her mouth was open, but she was not breathing. With the palm of her right hand, she struck the Shade's locked elbow and broke the joint with a loud crack. Varag's arm sagged, and for a moment Arya's toes brushed the floor. But then the bones in the Shade's arm popped back into place, and he lifted her even higher.
"You shall die," growled Varag. "You shall all die for imprisoning us in this cold, hard clay."
Knowing that Arya's and Saphira's lives were in peril stripped Aragorn of every emotion save that of implacable determination. His thoughts as sharp and clear as a shard of glass, he drove himself at the Shade's seething consciousness. Varag was too powerful, and the spirits that resided within him too disparate for Aragorn to overwhelm and control, so Aragorn sought to isolate the Shade. He surrounded Varag's mind with his own. Every time Varag attempted to reach out towards Saphira or Arya, Aragorn blocked the mental ray, and every time the Shade attempted to shift his body, Aragorn counteracted the urge with a command of his own. They battled at the speed of thought, fighting back and forth along the perimeter of the Shade's mind, which was a landscape so jumbled and incoherent, Aragorn feared it would drive him mad if he gazed at it for long. Aragorn pushed himself to the utmost as he duelled with Varag, striving to anticipate the Shade's every move, but he knew that their contest could only end with his own defeat. As fast as he was, Aragorn could not outthink the numerous intelligences contained within the Shade. Aragorn's concentration eventually wavered, and Varag seized upon the opportunity to force himself further into Aragorn's mind, trapping him, transfixing him, suppressing his thoughts until Aragorn could do no more than stare at the Shade with dumb rage. An excruciating tingling filled Aragorn's limbs as the spirits raced through his body, coursing down every one of his nerves.
"Your ring is full of light," exclaimed Varag, his eyes widening with pleasure. beautiful light. It will feed us for a long time.
Then he growled with anger as Arya grabbed his wrist and broke it in three places. She twisted free of Varog's grip before he could heal himself and dropped to the ground, gasping for air. Varog kicked at her, but she rolled out of the way. She reached for her fallen sword. Aragorn trembled as he struggled to cast off the Shade's oppressive presence. Arya's hand closed around the hilt of her sword. A wordless bellow escaped the Shade. He pounced on her, and they rolled across the floor, wrestling for control of the weapon. Arya shouted and struck Varog in the side of his head with the pommel of the sword. The Shade went limp for an instant, and Arya scrambled backward, pushing herself upright. In a flash, Aragorn freed himself from Varog. Without consideration for his own safety, he resumed his attack on the Shade's consciousness, his only thought to restrain the Shade for a few moments. Varog rose onto one knee, then faltered as Aragorn redoubled his efforts. "Get him!" Aragorn shouted. Arya lunged forward, her dark hair flying, and she stabbed the Shade through his heart. Aragorn winced and extricated himself from Varog's mind, even as the Shade recoiled from Arya, pulling himself off her blade. The Shade opened his mouth and uttered a piercing, dithering wail that shattered the panes of glass in the lantern above. He reached out toward Arya and tottered in her direction, then stopped as his skin faded and became transparent, revealing the dozens of glittering spirits trapped within the confines of his flesh. The spirits throbbed, growing in size, and Varog's skin split along the bellies of his muscles. With a final burst of light, the spirits tore Varog apart and fled the tower room, passing through the walls as if the stone were insubstantial. Aragorn's pulse gradually slowed. Then, feeling very old and very tired, he walked over to Arya, who stood leaning against a chair, cupping the front of her neck with a hand. She coughed, spitting up blood. Since she seemed incapable of talking, Aragorn placed his hand over hers and said, "Weeze heal." As the energy to mend her injuries flowed out of him, Aragorn's legs weakened, and he had to brace himself against the chair. "Better?" he asked as the spell finished its work. "Better," Arya whispered, and favored him with a weak smile. She motioned toward where Varog had been.
"We killed him. We killed him, and yet we did not die."
She sounded surprised.
"So few have ever killed a Shade and lived."
"That is because they fought alone, not together, like us."
"No, not like us."
"I had you to help me in Farthendur, and you had me to help you here."
"Yes."
"Now I shall have to call you Shadeslayer."
"We are both."
Saphira startled them by loosing a long, mournful keen. Still keening, she raked her claws across the floor, chipping and scratching the stones. Her tail whipped from side to side, smashing the furniture and the grim paintings on the walls.
"Gone," she said. "Gone. Gone forever."
"Saphira, what's wrong?" exclaimed Arya. When Saphira did not answer, Arya repeated the question to Aragorn. Hating the words he spoke, Aragorn said, "Oromis and Gleyda are dead. Galbatorix killed them." Arya staggered as if she had been hit.
"Ah,"
she said. She gripped the back of the chair so hard her knuckles turned white. Tears filled her slanted eyes, then spilled over onto her cheeks and coursed down her face.
"Aragorn."
She reached out and grasped his shoulder, and almost by accident, he found himself holding her in his arms. Aragorn felt his own eyes grow wet. He clenched his jaw in an effort to maintain his composure. If he started crying, he knew he would not be able to stop. He and Arya remained locked together for a long while, consoling each other. Then Arya withdrew and said,
"How did it happen?"
Oromis had one of his seizures, and while he was paralyzed, Galbatorix used Murtag to...
Aragorn's voice broke, and he shook his head.
I'll tell you about it along with Nasawada. She should know about this, and I don't want to have to describe it more than once.
Arya nodded.
Then let us go and see her.
Sunrise.
As Aragorn and Arya escorted Lady Lorana down from the room in the tower, they encountered Blodgarm and the 11 other elves, running up the staircase 4 steps at a time.
"Shadeslayer! Arya!"
exclaimed a female elf with long black hair.
"Are you hurt? We heard Saphira's lament and we thought one of you might have died."
Aragorn glanced at Arya. His oath of secrecy to Queen Islanzadi would not allow him to discuss Oromis or Gleyda while in the presence of anyone not from Dueldenvarden, such as Lady Lorana, without permission from the Queen, Arya, or whoever might succeed Islanzadi to the knotted throne in Ellesmira. She nodded and said,
"I release you from your vow, Aragorn. Both of you. Speak of them to whomever you choose."
"No, we are not hurt," Aragorn said. "However, Oromis and Gleyda have just died, slain in battle over Gilead." As one, the elves cried out in shock, and then began to ply Aragorn with dozens of questions. Arya raised a hand and said,
"Restrain yourselves. Now is not the time or place to satisfy your curiosity. There are still soldiers about, and we do not know who might be listening. Keep your sorrow hidden within your hearts until we are safe and secure."
She paused and looked at Aragorn, then said,
"I will explain the full circumstances of their deaths to you, once I know them myself."
"Nenono weonata, Arya Drotningu,"
they murmured.
"Did you hear my call?" Aragorn asked Blodgarm.
"I did," the fur-covered elf said. "We came as fast as we could, but there were many soldiers between here and there."
Aragorn twisted his hand over his chest in the elf's traditional gesture of respect.
"I apologize for leaving you behind, Blodgarm Elder. The heat of battle made me foolish and overconfident, and we nearly died because of my mistake."
"You need not apologize, Shadeslayer. We too made a mistake today. One which I promise we shall not repeat. From now on we will fight alongside you and the Varden without reserve."
Together they all trooped down the stairs to the courtyard outside.
The Varden had killed or captured most of the soldiers within the keep, and the few men who were still fighting surrendered once they saw that Lady Lorana was in the custody of the Varden. Since the stairwell was too small for her, Saphira had descended by wing to the courtyard, and was waiting for them when they arrived.
Aragorn stood with Saphira, Arya, and Lady Lorana, while one of the Varden fetched Jormungandr. When Jormungandr joined them, they informed him of what had happened within the tower, which amazed him greatly, and then gave over Lady Lorana to his custody. Jormungandr bowed to her.
"You may rest assured, lady, we shall treat you with the respect and dignity due your station. We may be your enemies, but we are still civilized men."
"Thank you," she replied. "I am relieved to hear it. However, my main concern now is for the safety of my subjects. If I might, I would like to speak with your leader, Nasawada, about her plans for them."
"I believe she wishes to speak with you as well."
As they parted, Lady Lorana said,
"I am most grateful to you, Elf, and to you as well, Dragon Rider, for killing that monster before he could wreak sorrow and destruction upon Feinster. Fate has placed us on opposite sides of this conflict, but that does not mean I cannot admire your bravery and prowess. We may never meet again, so fare thee well, both of you."
Aragorn bowed and said, "Fare thee well, Lady Lorana."
"May the stars watch over you," said Arya.
Blodgarm and the elves under his command accompanied Aragorn, Saphira, and Arya as they searched Feinster for Nasawada. They found her riding her stallion through the grey streets, inspecting the damage to the city. Nasawada greeted Aragorn and Saphira with evident relief.
I'm glad you have finally returned. We've needed you here these past few days. I see you have a new sword, Aragorn. A dragon rider's sword. Did the elves give it to you?
In an indirect way, yes. Aragorn eyed the various people standing nearby and lowered his voice.
Nasawada, we must talk with you alone. It's important.
Very well. Nasawada studied the buildings that lined the street, then pointed at a house that appeared abandoned.
Let us talk in there.
Two of Nasawada's guards, the Nighthawks, ran forward and entered the house. They reappeared a few minutes later and bowed to Nasawada, saying, It's empty, my lady.
Good. Thank you.
She dismounted her steed, handed the reins to one of the men in her retinue, and strode inside. Aragorn and Arya followed. The three of them wandered through the shabby building until they found a room, the kitchen, with a window large enough to accommodate Saphira's head. Aragorn pushed open the shutters, and Saphira laid her head on the wooden counter. Her breath filled the kitchen with the smell of charred meat.
We may speak without fear,
Arya announced, after casting spells that would prevent anyone from eavesdropping on their conversation. Nasawada rubbed her arms and shivered.
What is this all about, Aragorn?
She asked. Aragorn swallowed, wishing that he did not have to dwell upon Oromis and Glada's fate. Then he said,
Nasawada, Saphira and I were not alone. There was another dragon and another rider, fighting against Galbatorix.
I knew it,
breathed Nasawada, her eyes shining.
It was the only explanation that made sense. They were your teachers in Ellesmere, weren't they?
They were,
said Saphira.
But no more.
No more?
Aragorn pressed his lips together and shook his head, tears blurring his vision.
Just this morning, they died at Gilead. Galbatorix used Thorn and Murtag to kill them. I heard him speak to them with Murtag's tongue.
The excitement drained from Nasawada's face, replaced by a dull, empty expression. She sank into the nearest chair and stared at the cinders in the cold fireplace. The kitchen was silent. At last she stirred and said,
Are you sure they are dead?
Yes. Nasawada wiped her eyes on the hem of her sleeve.
Tell me about them, Aragorn. Would you, please?
So for the next half hour, Aragorn spoke of Oromis and Glada. He explained how they had survived the fall of the riders and why they had chosen to keep themselves hidden thereafter. He explained about their respective disabilities, and he spent some time describing their personalities and what it had been like to study under them. Aragorn's sense of loss deepened as he remembered the long days he had spent with Oromis on the crags of Telnair, and the many things the elf had done for him and Saphira. As he came to their encounter with Thorn and Murtag at Gilead, Saphira lifted her head off the counter and began to keen again. A mournful wail, soft and persistent. Afterward, Nasawada sighed and said,
I wish I could have met Oromis and Glada, but alas, it was not to be. There is one thing I still do not understand, Aragorn. You said you heard Galbatorix speaking to them. How could you?
Yes, I would like to know that as well, said Arya.
Aragorn looked for something to drink, but there was no water or wine in the kitchen. He coughed, then launched into an account of their recent trip to Ellesmere. Saphira occasionally made a comment, but for the most part she left it to him to tell the story. Starting with the truth about his parentage, Aragorn proceeded in quick succession through the events of their stay, from their discovery of the Brightsteel under the Manoa tree to the forging of Brisinga to his visit with Sloane. Last of all, he told Arya and Nasawada about the dragon's heart of hearts.
Well,
said Nasawada. She stood and walked the length of the kitchen and then back again.
You, the son of Brom, and Galbatorix leeching off the souls of dragons whose bodies have died. It's almost too much to comprehend.
She rubbed her arms again.
At least we now know the true source of Galbatorix's power.
Arya stood motionless, breathless, her expression stunned.
The dragons are still alive, she whispered.
She clasped her hands together in a prayer-like fashion and held them against her chest. They are still alive after all these years. Oh, if only we could tell the rest of my race. How they would rejoice, and how terrible their wrath would be when they heard of the enslavement of the Eldunari. We would run straight to Urubane, and we would not rest until we had freed the hearts of Galbatorix's control, no matter how many of us died in the process.
But we cannot tell them,
said Saphira.
No, said Arya, and lowered her gaze. We cannot, but I wish we could.
Nasawada looked at her.
Please do not take offence, but I wish that your mother, Queen Islanzadi, had seen fit to share this information with us. We could have made use of it long ago. I agree, said Arya, frowning. On the burning plains, Murtag was able to defeat the two of you.
She indicated Aragorn and Saphira.
Because you did not know that Galbatorix might have given him some of the Eldunari, and thus you failed to act with appropriate caution. If not for Murtag's conscience, you would both be trapped in Galbatorix's service even now. Oromis and Gleda, and my mother too, had sound reasons for keeping the Eldunari a secret, but their reticence was nearly our undoing. I will discuss this with my mother when next we speak.
Nasawada paced between the counter and the fireplace.
You have given me much to think about, Aragorn.
She tapped the floor with the tip of her boot.
For the first time in the history of the Varden, we know of a way to kill Galbatorix that might actually succeed. If we can separate him from these Heart of Hearts, he will lose the better part of his strength, and then you and our other spellcasters will be able to overpower him.
Yes, but how can we separate him from his hearts?
Aragorn asked. Nasawada shrugged.
I could not say, but I am sure it must be possible. From now on, you will work on devising a method. Nothing else is as important.
Aragorn felt Arya studying him with unusual concentration. Unsettled, he made a questioning face at her.
I always wondered, said Arya, why Saphira's egg appeared to you, and not somewhere in an empty field. It seemed too great a coincidence to have occurred purely by chance. But I could not think of any plausible explanation. Now I understand. I should have guessed that you were Brom's son. I did not know Brom well, but I did know him, and you share a certain resemblance.
I do?
You should be proud to call Brom your father, said Nasawada. By all accounts, he was a remarkable man. If not for him, the Varden wouldn't exist. It seems fitting that you are the one to carry on his work.
Then Arya said,
Aragorn, may we see Gleda's Eldunari?
Aragorn hesitated, then went outside and retrieved the pouch from Saphira's saddlebags. Careful not to touch the Eldunari, he loosened the drawstring at the top and allowed the pouch to slide down around the golden gem-like stone. In contrast to when he had last seen it, the glow within the Heart of Hearts was dim and feeble, as if Gleda were barely conscious. Nasawada leaned forward and stared into the swirling center of the Eldunari, her eyes gleaming with reflected light.
And Gleda is really inside of here?
He is,
said Saphira.
Can I speak with him?
You could try, but I doubt he would respond.
He just lost his rider. It will take him a long time to recover from the shock, if ever. Please leave him be, Nasawada. If he wished to speak with you, he would have done so already. Of course. It was not my intention to disturb him in his time of grief. I shall wait to meet him until such time as he has regained his composure.
Arya moved closer to Aragorn and placed her hands on either side of the Eldunari, her fingers less than an inch away from its surface. She gazed at the stone with an expression of reverence, seemingly lost within its depths, then whispered something in the ancient language.
Glader's consciousness flared slightly, as if in response. Arya lowered her hands.
Aragorn, Saphira, you have been given the most solemn responsibility, the safekeeping of another life. Whatever happens, you must protect Glader. With Oromis gone, we shall need his strength and wisdom more than ever before.
Do not worry, Arya. We won't allow any misfortune to befall him,
Saphira promised. Aragorn covered the Eldunari with the pouch again, and fumbled with the drawstring, exhaustion rendering him clumsy. The Varden had won an important victory, and the elves had taken Gilead, but the knowledge brought him little joy. He looked at Nasawada and asked, "What now?" Nasawada lifted her chin. "Now," she said, "we will march north to Bel-Atona, and when we have captured it, we will proceed onward to Drasleona and seize it as well, and then to Urubain, where we will cast down Galbatorix or die trying. That is what we shall do now, Aragorn." After they left Nasawada, Aragorn and Saphira agreed to leave Feinster for the Varden's camp, so that they could both rest, undisturbed by the cacophony of noises within the city. With Blodgarm and the rest of Aragorn's guards ranged around them, they walked toward the main gates of Feinster, Aragorn still carrying Glader's Heart of Hearts in his arms. Neither of them spoke. Aragorn stared at the ground between his feet. He paid little attention to the men who ran or marched past. His part in the battle was finished, and all he wanted to do was lie down and forget the sorrows of the day. The last sensations he had felt from Glader still reverberated through his mind. He was alone. He was alone and in the dark. Alone! Aragorn's breath caught as a wave of nausea swept over him. So that is what it's like to lose your rider or your dragon. No wonder Galbatorix went insane.
We are the last,
Saphira said. Aragorn frowned, not understanding.
The last free dragon and rider,
she explained.
We are the only ones left. We are...
alone.
Yes.
Aragorn stumbled as his foot struck a loose stone he had overlooked. Miserable, he closed his eyes for a moment.
We can't do this by ourselves, he thought. We can't. We're not ready.
Saphira agreed, and her grief and anxiety combined with his nearly incapacitated him. When they arrived at the city gates, Aragorn paused, reluctant to push his way through the large crowd gathered in front of the opening, trying to flee Feinster. He glanced around for another route. As his eyes passed over the outer walls, a sudden desire gripped him to see the city in the light of day. Veering away from Saphira, he ran up a staircase that led to the top of the walls. Saphira uttered a short growl of annoyance and followed, half opening her wings as she jumped from the street to the parapet in a single bound. They stood together on the battlements for the better part of an hour, and watched as the sun rose. One by one, rays of pale gold light streaked across the verdant fields from the east, illuminating the countless motes of dust that drifted through the air. Where the rays struck a column of smoke, the smoke glowed orange and red, and billowed with renewed urgency. The fires among the hovels outside the city walls had mostly died out, although since Aragorn and Saphira had arrived, the fighting had set a score of houses within Feinster ablaze, and the pillars of flame that leaped up from the disintegrating houses lent the cityscape an eerie beauty. Behind Feinster, the shimmering sea stretched out to the far, flat horizon, where the sails of a ship ploughing its way northward were just visible. As the sun warmed Aragorn through his armour, his melancholy gradually dissipated, like the wreaths of mist that adorned the rivers below. He took a deep breath and exhaled, relaxing his muscles.
No, he said, we are not alone. I have you and you have me, and there is Arya and Nasawada and Oryk and many others besides who will help us along our way.
And Glader too,
said Saphira.
Aye.
Aragorn gazed down at the Eldunari that lay covered within his arms, and felt a rush of sympathy and protectiveness toward the dragon who was trapped inside the Heart of Hearts. He hugged the stone closer to his chest and laid a hand upon Saphira, grateful for their companionship.
We can do this, he thought. Galbatorix isn't invulnerable. He has a weakness, and we can use that weakness against him. We can do this.
We can, and we must, said Saphira.
For the sake of our friends and our family.
And for the rest of Alagasia.
We must do this.
Aragorn lifted Glaida's Eldunari over his head, presenting it to the sun and the new day, and he smiled, eager for the battles yet to come, so that he and Saphira might finally confront Galbatorix and kill the Dark King. And now, an exclusive interview between Christopher Paolini and his editor, Michelle Fry.
Hi, I'm Michelle Fry, editor at Knopf & Crown Books for Young Readers, and I'm sitting here today with Christopher Paolini, the author of The Inheritance Cycle and of Brisinger, the book that you are listening to right now. Hi, Christopher.
Hi.
I'm going to ask you a few questions just to chat a little about Brisinger and about your writing process and have a conversation with you. Question for you. What is it like for you to sit down and write a new book? How do you start a book? And do you miss the characters in between books?
Actually, I do miss the characters. Since I just finished Brisinger, I was just working on a short story for my own amusement. And about a few pages into it, I walked over and found my mom, and I was telling her that I was missing writing about Aragorn and Saphira and Arya and all the other characters from Alagasia. I've been with them so long now. Actually, this year, 2008, when Brisinger is being released, this marks the 10th year since I began the Inheritance Cycle.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time to live with these characters.
It is, and I've found that I've become very, very comfortable with them. It's easy for me to slip into their voices. I've done so much with Aragorn at this point, and Saphira and the other characters, that writing a scene from their point of view or about them is, I won't say it's easy at this point. I mean, writing is never easy, but it's comfortable. So as far as how I approach writing a new book, I would probably approach a book outside of this series a little bit differently. But in general, my approach for each book in the Inheritance Cycle has been to plot out the main events of the book in fairly explicit detail, usually about a paragraph or so for every main event that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get a good feel for where the story's going, the general flow and arc of structure of the plot. And I usually spend a few weeks or a month on that, just trying to nail that down to my satisfaction. And then I dive in and start chewing away. And of course, when I'm actually writing the book, the outline, although it serves as a useful guide, I don't adhere to it religiously. I feel free to make changes and alter things as I'm going along, because sometimes something that seemed to make sense before I began the book no longer makes sense when I'm actually in the scene with the characters and they want to do something other than what I had originally planned.
Do you have an example of that from Brisinger, a moment that deviated from your original plan?
Sure. When Aragorn finds Sloane in Hellgrind,
mm-hmm.
when I was first imagining the overall structure of the book, I had thought that I might have Aragorn kill Sloane.
Wow.
Well, there were a lot of reasons for it. I mean, Sloane had committed all these crimes, and taking Sloane back, I mean, he would have only been executed in any case for his crimes. So I thought, well, you know, Aragorn is a dragon rider, and I don't want to maybe drag out the storyline anymore, I could just have him kill Sloane. But when I actually got to that point in the story, and Aragorn was there staring at the butcher, and It just didn't feel right to go in that direction with Aragorn. It didn't feel like Aragorn would do that. You know, maybe Rohan would have done it, maybe. Certainly Arya might have done it, or I know Saphira would have done it. She would have just eaten Sloane.
And a tasty meal, too.
And a tasty meal, but not Aragorn.